Good afternoon. It's getting to be that time of year when everything's getting very busy, as you'll see when I go down my list of things to worry about. Just to set the context, we have four lectures left, today's and into the first week of May. And what will happen is if you look at the timetable, I think the midterm has two sittings as the final will have two sittings as the midterm did. One will be, I think, the day after the last lecture, and the other one will be early in the succeeding week. Again, so if people have travel plans, one or the other is likely to work. What I'll be doing today is a number of things. We have the graded number 3 back, and I'll be passing that around. You probably saw on Piazza that information about it. Most people did very well. I think the typical grade was very close to 100. We have the sheet, and it shows you what you lost points on if you did lose points. One anomaly we did discover yesterday was that a number of the tests are randomly generated. And at least one person who had trouble with the if-then, if-then-else construct lost additional points, incorrectly, I believe, because when they did a random test, some of those randomly contained ifs. And of course, if the if-then test failed, then other ifs are going to fail too. But that's kind of like double jeopardy. I was going to say double indemnity. That's a good double. Double jeopardy is where you beat the rap and they try you a second time and in the situation. So that if you had trouble with your if-thens and you noticed and you lost points fairly on that, let's assume, and you also, when you look at the list of the random tests you failed, they all have the property, they have an if sitting in them, then it's fair to contact the TA and say, yeah, these failed, but they failed because they had ifs and I already paid the price for that. There may be others like that, but that's at least one I saw. So that's one of the reasons why I like to hand back the sheet, is that you can get exactly the list of what you failed on, double check the TA, and see if, in fact, what he considered wrong was, in fact, wrong. And he's going to have a heck of a time when he does Project 4. Project 3 is going to be easy compared to 4, with all these error messages phrased, who knows what way, and some people, you know, say the type's wrong, the other says, no, it's not a scalar, and the other says, no, it's not assignable to, and somebody else yells, all of the above, and it gets interesting. So a couple of things then. Let me first start around Project 5. That's the last one you will be doing. And let me add, I'll be handing around next week, but I'll put it online earlier, is some detailed notes about code generation. So when you read the code generation in your assignment, you can say, my gosh, I don't know anything about the Java virtual machine, or very little. How in the world am I going to generate code for it? And what happens, the notes will make detailed suggestions about, if you're trying to do this construct, here's the right kind of code. If you're doing another kind of construct, here's an alternative kind of code. And as the assignment will say, there's a cute little trick you can play, and some of you may know about this, others perhaps not. It turns out that CSX is very similar to Java in the things it implements. And there's a way in Java to say, Mr. Java compiler, please show me the code you generated for this Java program, which in many cases will be very close or identical to the code you could generate for CSX for a corresponding construct. So if Java, for example, implements an if-then with such a sequence of code, there's no reason why you couldn't implement an if-then with a similar or identical sequence of code. And that's perfectly legal. You can just go ahead and see. I'm sure you and your competitors do the same thing. Before you implement product X, if a competitor has product X prime, you go in and try it and see what's good about it, what's bad about it, et cetera. You don't do that? Your competitors do it to you, though, don't they? Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's cool. I mean, I always thought that was kind of standard. Do unto others before they do unto you sort of thing. At any rate, let me start these around and you probably won't worry about too much about this because, again, virtually all of you will be doing an exam tomorrow, and then some of you are still working on 4 through tonight or into the rest of the week. So let me just start this around. And I'm just guesstimating on how many are needed. Oh, maybe I guesstimated wrong. So if any extras reach the back of the room, pass them over to another aisle. So what I'll do now is hand back the sheets for Project 4. And again, this is detailed notes about what you did right, what you did wrong. Your grade you've probably already seen. That's already up on Learn at UW. But the detailed sheets aren't. What happens is he simply creates a file with all the sheets in here, and then I just print them out one by one. So Brian Baker. Juniad Begawala. Jonathan Block. Matt Brofsky. Eric Boyd. Theodore Brenner. Blake Campbell. Carl Carlson. Josh Ansad. The D is not pronounced, right? Shansar?
That's right.
Okay, we'll get it. The team of Quinlan Karsten and Ryan Colippi. Clark Downham. Lorian Drager. Sam Felt. Timothy Feiereisen. Benjamin Fleming. The team of Brandon Frank and Mason Mandan. Dan Gerber. Does anybody not get Simon 5? Okay, get some extras, okay. There's Dan. Last name, G-E. Timothy Gieselman. The team of Tricia Pearly and Eric Gross. I feel almost like I'm doing Academy Awards where you get all the people. Which? Gieselman, yeah. Hamad Osama. Team of Jacob Harper and Grant Gentoff Johnson. There we got to get a team. Yeah, we made it. Thanks, Mom. Michael Hudson. Oh, maybe Eugene Yuan. Stuart Isaac. Dustin Carrolls with a K. Susanna Kelly. Team of Kristen Moore and Michael Kellum. And accepting for the team we have. Yeah. Sure. Stephen Lampier. Ooh. I think these pages are both yours. Yeah. Corin Lawrence. John Liu, Tim Lohr, James Majewski, Dustin Maiden, Luke Matthews. Lynn McCormick. Andrew Mironovich. Nicholas Moloch. Whistler Blaze Norton. So which is the first name?
Blaze.
Okay. Matthew Owen. Robert Owen. The team of Joel Thompson and Trey Pick. Elazir Posner. Catherine Procknow. Malcolm Reed. Patrick Robichaud. Team of Michael Santana and Allison Kator. Nicholas Schober. Emma Schultz. Denzel Showers. Punat Singh. Ryan Smith. Wesley Somatula. Sorry about that. Derek Thompson. Joel Thompson. Raghuram Vempathy. Christopher Viernig. David Whalen. Michael White. Daniel Wilmer. Kwang Yin, Daniel Yogerst, and Zun Zhao. You're Daniel? Okay. And if anybody came late, what I've been doing is handing back Project 3 sheets, and you can pick those up if I miss you on first call in the first break. I also, for people who came in late, handed around assignment number 5. Just keep you aware of that, and I'll be sending out extra information about it later this week. Also, while I was getting out getting some refreshments, somebody put an exam book on my desk here with no name and some work in the middle. Was this just scrap you found?
It was just sitting on the
desk. Okay, that's probably from the previous exam. It does look like one of my questions, but I'll just assume it's scrap. So I'll remind you, although probably most of you are already well familiar with it, is the second midterm will be tomorrow in this room, 5:30 to 7:30. I'll get here a bit early for anybody who has any last-minute questions. We went over last week some questions on the exam, but it may be the case that something's come up in between. So is anybody having any pressing question that they'd really like dealt with now? So you'll feel comfortable with it come tomorrow? Yeah.
This might be too general, but if you try to write a regular expression, it's very hard to say, to come with a regular expression for everything except that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it turns out, remember, complement is an operator. So you can put the thing that you want to exclude and complement it, and that'll give you everything else.
But that doesn't really give us what we want.
That sometimes it doesn't. That's right. And
so for example, it would be, like you say, star slash followed by anything except star slash followed by slash star.
Right. Those can be a little nasty because you got to get the pattern to include most everything and exclude just this or that.
But is there any, so I'm sure I can solve each of these kinds of problems like on their own with a lot of work and just thinking, if I'm excluding that, what am I really doing?
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes you need to be careful. It's just like an ordinary program to get it to do just what you want and not too much and not too little. The great example is the C comment. And a lot of people had problems with it the first time through. And at least one exam question, I said, okay, you paid the price on question one. Can you, now that you presumably are more comfortable with it, do a modest extension to it? There was one where, besides excluding star slash in the body, you also wanted to exclude slash star for fear of having one comment eat the beginning of a second comment. And that's doable by the same principles, but there's no magic way of doing it. You have to kind of say, the trick on this is saying, well, if I put down one of these, how do I avoid putting down one of those and yet allowing everything that's valid? And that sometimes takes a little head scratching, and it's programming of another sort. And some programs are easy and others are subtle, and those can be.
So is there a way, given a string of length 2 or greater, to just write a regular expression, everything except for the string?
A single string? Yeah, that's where a complement would work fine, wouldn't it?
But if it's of length 2 or greater,
okay.
And you want to say match everything except for this string.
Everything except strings length 2 or greater?
Of this particular, you want to write the regular expression instead of just learning how to write not star slash. How do we learn to write not x, y?
It depends on how complex the string is. It's just, in some cases, what happens is there's this temptation to use complement and say everything but. That oftentimes fails because the things you say everything but include sometimes the thing that you are trying to exclude as a substring. So those don't usually work, and sometimes it's just a detailed sort of pattern. Some are easy, some are harder. If I put it on the exam, I believe there's probably something that fits in half a page or so and is doable within a reasonable fraction of 2 hours. But as I'm about to say there, you always have the golden option of not doing the question. There will be the fact that, I'll guarantee you this, that you'll have at least one question you can exclude. And it can either be the easy one, because you would be insulted to be asked to answer something that simple, or maybe the hardest one for just the opposite reason. But there will be a choice. But I mean, it's one of these things there, it's like programming in general. If there was some golden rule about how to do excellent programs, everybody on the street would be programmers, and we'd all be out of jobs, or at least out of good paying jobs. We'd be doing the cleanup rather than making the mess that somebody else cleans up. Yeah. There is a way of doing it. In fact, somebody was going to send me email. Was it you? Was going to send me email about it, and I forgot about it. There is a way, and I think I have it in one of the old versions of the book. Actually, the current text is in its third generation. And at some point, we thought about putting it in, and one of my co-authors said, nobody cares about that anymore. But it does exist, and it's kind of a cute little algorithm, but it's more just for your interest. The other way around is more important, because that's how you build scanner generators. Other questions? Right. Yeah. I mean, in terms of, we did it last week, but anything that was excluded then, yes.
So show that no such regular expression or finite automaton is possible. Like, what exactly?
That's usually turns out to be a variation of the balanced brackets problem. There's a couple of encodings of that. One was not equal, and the other one was a palindrome, and maybe I had a third or fourth that I dreamt up in terms of that. Right. Yeah, the standard way I would do it in that case, if I believed it was similar to the brackets, would say, okay, You claim it is regular. There must be an automaton. Show it to me. Because, you know, and just give it to me to play with. And then I start doing this trick of feeding a number of strings into it until a state repeats. So I say, for this string and this different string, I visit the same state. And that must happen because it's finite, and I just feed longer and longer strings till it happens. I then show these two strings visiting the same state have an unacceptable consequence. Usually it's the case that one suffix should lead to an accepting state, and another suffix should lead to a non-accepting state, and yet starting at the same state, they're either going to go one way or the other because it's deterministic, and hence something fails. But I said, assume it exists. And you could give me any clever one you had, and they all fail. So if they all fail, it must be because there's no valid one that can be created. So that's the level of explanation I would like to see. Be careful. Sometimes people say, well, it's going to have to remember a real, real long string, and it's only finite, and that may not work. That's sort of the starting point. But you could have made the same argument incorrectly on the assignment, which is one of the reasons I did it, about the mod 3 business. You could try to read the whole string and then do the remaindering later, and that would not work. But it turned out in this case you could do the remaindering bit by bit by bit. And in other cases, like, say, the balanced brackets, that doesn't work because you can have a surplus or a deficit arbitrarily large. So there's no way to sort of partially piece it away, say, I'll match one bracket against another and be done with it because the other brackets are too far away. Other questions? Okay. So let's see. So we talked about the midterm tomorrow. Project 4 is due today, and I have one thing I'm going to go over towards the bottom of the page about checking method calls. That always is the most difficult, I think, from people doing type checking. So if you have a problem with that, I'll be going through that shortly. Any remaining problems that you have about type checking, about how do I check this or how do we do that? I've answered a lot on Piazza, but there may be some that haven't been answered or haven't been answered to your satisfaction. One thing that people notice, and this is certainly a problem, is that exactly how many errors should a certain circumstance engender? I mean, how many messages should you have? At a basic, you want to have at least one to say there's something wrong with this. But the ideal, and sometimes this is easy and sometimes it's not so easy, is to say, if this existed, how many fixes would a user have to do? Sometimes it's, of course, one, but sometimes it's more than one. So, for example, there might be a situation where you're trying to assign a Boolean array to an integer scalar. Well, it turns out that, Boolean can't be assigned to integers by themselves, so you have a type problem. But even if you fixed it and changed it to correct type, you can't assign a whole array to a scalar. You can index it and get a single value, of course, and assign it. So in a sense, you have two things you have to fix. Namely, you have an array and a non-array, that's a kind issue, and a mismatched type, that's a type error. So the ideal there would be two different errors, because fixing the one won't automatically fix the other. That's easier said than done, but that's sort of the motivation and the way to think about it. And certainly it's the case that you can phrase things differently. In some cases, for example, you try to use a method, not in a call, but just as a bare method name, in all sorts of crazy ways. And sometimes an error message would come up, you can't assign to it, which is true, because you can't assign to methods. Methods are constants of a sort. And it's also the case, you know, that it might be the case that you're using a method in a context where a method call is really what would be appropriate. So you could also say, hey, you can't use a method except in the context of a call, which in our language is true. You can use method names, but they always have to have parentheses after it to invoke the call. Just the method name by itself doesn't work. And finally, there's at least one question that comes up there that sometimes you have to worry about a screwball series of things happening. And again, I guess when you're developing your software, you know, what if you get the world's dumbest user and the user does this and this and this and this and that? What happens then? I remember I had a friend when I was in graduate school who was Jewish and Orthodox Jewish. And he told me about a little game he and his colleague used to play about figuring out the maximum number of sins you could do in one act. So, you know, you would seduce somebody's wife and kill somebody and eat a cheeseburger all at the same time, all of which were sinful and that. So it's a situation, if you get this oddball combination, how far do you need to go to catch it? And particularly what I had in mind is, in my solution, a situation, how do I test, and we'll get to that when we get to the final couple of notes on type checking, is how do you check whether a break or continue is inside of a loop or not? The trick I play, and it's the way it works in most cases, is I check the label. And what happens is I play a game with the label, that the label has to be declared, and sometimes it's visible, and sometimes it's invisible. It's visible if you're inside the loop that it labels, because there it can be used. It becomes invisible if you're outside the loop. And therefore, visible versus invisible tells you whether you're inside a proper loop or not. But there's one case that I didn't cover and somebody caught, and I won't hold you to it because I didn't hold myself to it, namely, what if the label is undefined? So now you've created two grievous errors. Namely, you use an undeclared identifier, so I can't tell, if it's visible or invisible, it doesn't exist. And therefore, I can't tell whether this break or continue is inside of a loop or not. And my feeling on that one is, you'll certainly give at least a message saying this identifier is undeclared. Once it becomes declared, presumably you'll either complain it's not a label, in which case that has to get fixed again, or if it is a label, then you can tell, are you inside the loop or outside the loop, and do that check. If you want to be really a purist about it, I mentioned, I think, in passing, one trick you could play is that you can tell if you're inside of a loop or not, similar to the way you can tell if you're inside of a method or not. Namely, when you start type checking the body of a loop, set a flag saying, I'm in a loop. When you get done type checking that entire subtree and you leave it, you say, I'm no longer in a loop. And you can check that. But the visible versus invisible does much the same thing, except it doesn't handle this one odd case that if you try to break or continue on an undeclared label, how do you tell if you're inside of a loop or not? This little thing about setting the flag independently of visible, invisible would do it. But again, it's such an oddball error that I'm not sure I'd really feel like I want to compel you to worry about that. But that's the nature of the game. How many errors are there? Exactly what error did you do, et cetera? And again, those of you in quality assurance or product design must have similar sorts of things. If they do this, and that crazy thing, what do I do? And it's probably, the best thing, I don't know if any of your products do that, is what they used to do in Star Trek. Remember when you asked the computer to do a tough enough problem, it would all start smoking and go into a puff of smoke, and you were so smart that you devastated the computer and caused it to self-destruct. And in a funny way, you can actually do that. Does anybody know you can actually sort of almost cause a machine to self-destruct? Does anybody know how to do it on modern machines? What you do it is, there are certain command sequences that take so much energy that you can actually start running the thing and it starts getting hotter and hotter and the fan has to go on. I'm sure if any of you have laptops, occasionally you've done something that made the fan go on, something like multimedia or so on. So I think it's possible that if the fan can't keep up with the heat the processor is generating, it shuts itself off. It's not self-destructing, but it turns itself off, and it's almost as cool. So you can actually, do something kind of similar to what Star Trek did, although the writers of Star Trek didn't have any idea about computers. And Project 5, that's already been shown. So let me go through this again. Just people have residual questions on. So I'll first talk about doing procedure processing for non-overloaded methods. So what's going to happen is in the symbol table, you're going to want to store a list of type and kind pairs at declaration time per parameter. So the length of the list will tell you how many parameters, possibly zero, and then the type would be integer, boolean, char, and the kind would typically be a scalar parameter or an array parameter. And that would say what you're expecting. At the point of call, after you've type-checked each individual parameter to make sure it didn't have internal errors, you would revisit it and say, what is the type and kind? And you get that. It could be a scalar, for example. It could be an array parameter, the various kinds of values you can have. And after you have those, and I have an example here. So here's an example of what I've been mentioning. So in this particular case, at the definition point, we say, hey, M's a method, and because it's a method, it's going to have a parameter list. And in this case, it would say, type check this guy. He's an integer, and he's a scalar parameter. The second entry says he's a Boolean, and because the square brackets are there, he's an array parameter. And you just store that. It expects two parameters, one of which is a scalar, is an integer scalar, and the other of which is a Boolean array. You then later on find a call. So I first type check this and true and false type check properly. I then go back and revisit the nodes. How do I do that? Well, I don't want to necessarily type check it again, but of course I can create auxiliary methods that are specialized in their purpose. This is one where it says, okay, I type checked the parameter, so type and kind information should be there. And therefore go back and just extract that into a list form so that in this case I would say, what's true? It's Boolean and it's a value. What's false? It's also Boolean and a value. I would then say, okay, M, how many parameters do you expect? 2. How many parameters do I have? 2. So it's fine so far. If it isn't, you would give an error message saying, error, wrong number of parameters supplied for method M. I would then do a parameter by parameter match. So it has to be the type, has to be the same, and the kind has to be compatible. Compatible usually means scalars with scalars and arrays with arrays. So the first one would say, okay, I'm a Boolean value and integer scalar parameter. Well, integer and Boolean don't match, so it's a type error. The kind is okay. A value can be a scalar parameter. So I've given an error message on that, no error, you know, on parameter 1. I'd want to continue on because maybe additional parameters are messed up, and in this case they are. So the second parameter would be checked, and it says, well, in this particular case, he is a Boolean, but he's a value, which is a scalar, and array parameter is an array, and that's a wrong kind. So I give a second error message saying the second parameter fails and explain why, you know, that a scalar was expected and, I'm sorry, an array was expected and a scalar was provided. And again, how you phrase that is up to you, just something along that line. So that's basically how you do declarations and calls absent overloading. So what do we do if we are into overloading? So now what's going to happen at the point of declaration, you'll allow yourself to have not just a single list of parameters, but a list of parameters, one for each overloading. So when you declare, you would again get a list of parameters for this declaration, compare them against the list of prior declarations to make sure there's not an illegal redefinition. That might be that you already declared M of integer I, or integer whatever, and you're redeclaring M with another definition of integer I. That doesn't work. There has to be a difference in the length or in one particular position or more, a difference in the type or kind so that I can distinguish them. So in this particular case, you verify that this is a valid overloading and simply add a new list to a list of possibilities. And as you might expect when I get around the call, I'm going to go ahead and say I'll find one match, not necessarily the first one, but some match. So at the point of call, I'll again create a list of parameters as supplied by the caller. And then for each parameter list, I'll say, do you work? So I say I create a little method that's a Boolean and says, yes, you're valid or no, you're not. Because of my earlier definition, at most one parameter sequence can match. If I could match more than one, that means there'd be a legal redefinition, and I already have caught that. So I'll simply go along and saying, if you don't match, fine, I'll try the next and the next and then the next. If I find one, bingo, that's the one that the user must have meant, and I'll accept it. And if I try them all and none of them work, then I give an error message, error, you know, parameter, supply, do not match any of the overloaded definitions that are available. And again, the phrasing is up to you, but that's essentially the idea behind it. And if you do it that way, extending into handling overloading isn't that much of an extra difficulty. It is a bit of extra work, but I think it's important for realistic languages to understand that these do exist and you have to handle it. Yeah, question in the back. Absolutely. That's sort of the way you perhaps have programmed C++. C++ does something called name mangling. And you've had the pleasure, I guess, of link editing C++ programs and the mangled names have to be. So what he's saying is, let me show you here, is that an alternative, and in fact, we'll do a little something like that actually in the Java virtual machine, is that you don't consider method name M by itself. You consider method M qualified by some parameter information. So you might have something like M and use the letter I for int, or M of I array for an integer array. And again, you'd have a standard notation for it. So if I overloaded M to have a single integer scalar, it would be written something like that. I'm putting the parens in for readability. They don't really need to be there, but they certainly could be. And a second definition, which is different, says I'm an integer array. And now what happens is if you put these in standard form, it becomes essentially just a string comparer. Does your so-called signature, the fact I'm a method, I take one parameter and the coding says the type and the kind. And either they match or they don't. I look it up, and now I don't have one definition of M. I have alternative definitions of M qualified by their types. That certainly works also. And if you've already done that, it sounds like you have, then that's a very reasonable alternative. You got to be careful, of course, to make sure that the signatures are in a uniform format. But we'll see we do something not dissimilar to that in the Java virtual machine, so it certainly is a viable solution. Other questions? You can get into that problem if you allow overloading that has the same parameter types but different result types. Somebody pointed out that in my definition, I was very strict about having all overloadings have the same result type. Somebody pointed out quite correctly that C and other languages, C++ at least, allow you to have alternative return types as long as the parameter types vary. The thing I was talking about was this thing called Baker's algorithm, where if I allow you to have two or more definitions with the same parameters, so just looking at the call is not enough to give me full info, I can put up the situation that maybe this is an integer or maybe this is a float. And what I have to do is percolate this through and see which one causes an eventual type error and which one doesn't. But I may have many calls. So I could have something with a call plus a call minus a call. And I'm not sure, are all of them going to do integers? Are all of them going to do float? Are they going to do a mixture? Do I favor ones that don't have to do typecasting or not? And it turns out to be more complex than people want. So in simple cases, it'd be cool. What would be really nice is simply have conversion methods that go ahead and return the type you want. That I could take, call a method and say, give me my distance from the Milky Way or something, Andromeda, right? So what's our distance? Which way is Andromeda? That way? I don't know where it went. So give me my distance to Andromeda, and you could either have the local Andromeda or the one out in outer space. And say, give it to me in kilometers. Or I guess parsecs or something, and have overloadings that say if I want parsecs, it'll compute parsecs. If I want kilometers, it'll compute kilometers. So there'd be some cool uses of it, but when they start intermixing, it makes type checking way harder, which is why people are reluctant to do it. But it can be done. And there's at least one language, a language called Ada, that was a successor to Pascal that was popular in the 80s. And it shows you the interesting politics about it. I mean, you think politics was just invented today. It certainly wasn't. The Ada language was a really nice design, but it was designed at the auspices of the U.S. Department of Defense because they wanted a standardized language to be used by all military organizations. It was a good intent. But all of a sudden, it's the military language. And if you work on the Ada project, you're an incipient militarist in a situation there. And just like the people who said, "You know, I will never accept money from the U.S. Army, the Office of Research. NSF, which is still government money, that's fine, because that's not tainted by the military. And actually, the language, a lot of people would not use the language for just that purpose. And it sort of died because it acquired a bad reputation. But it was technically a pretty good language. And that one did allow that. So things, I'm sure you learned that. Things can fail for the wrong reasons and succeed for the wrong reasons. And that's just sort of life. So other questions on that? Okay, what I'd like to do next, then, is go up and finish up some of the overview of type checking. You've already done some of this, but some of you may still be worrying about this. And let me get this guy. Oops. Sorry. Back again, yeah. That's not it. That's the guy I wanted. So when I ended last time, we were doing binary operators. And again, you may have done some of this already, so I'll just go through this fairly quickly. But in this particular case, this is a good example of showing where it is in cases where you continue checking and other cases where you simply bail at some point. So in this case, the binary operators have the property that by looking at the operator, you know what sort of types are expected in the operands. In cases where you have richer languages, say you happen to have Java where plus could do not just integers as they do in our language, but they can also add floating points and the various lengths of floating point, and they can also add strings. So then things get a little bit more complex. Something I haven't even begun to get into, but C and C++ do it all the time, is where you have what they used to call mixed mode. What happens when you have a plus and one of them is an int, and one of them is a float? Do you call that an error? You can. But then the user said, oh, you stupid compiler. I know what you wanted. I wanted to add 1 to 3.33, which makes perfect sense. So some languages have a rule that if you have a variety of operand types, you do something called widening. Widening sort of says you get a more inclusive type. And in some ways, float is more inclusive than integers because it can represent most integers. Except for the precision issues, it could represent all integers and fractional parts included. So many languages say, oh, what that user really means is take the integer, generalize it to a float by doing some conversion operation. Because inside of a machine, floating point numbers and integer numbers are represented very differently, and then do the addition. And you know, you can see, you know, in general how things can get a little bit out of hand. So we don't have quite all that, but I wanted to warn you that it did exist. So one of the things you've noticed in this situation is that oftentimes the way you type check anything is first by type checking the children. There's one exception. I mentioned that, and many of you probably discovered it. If not, maybe I'll give you a little bit of advance warning. The one thing that is not type checked uniformly by visiting the child in all cases is identifiers. And the trouble with an identifier visiting it is, identifiers can be used in two different ways. They can be used as part of a declaration or part of a use. A declaration normally puts things in a symbol table. A use fetches information from a symbol table. So if I uniformly type checked an integer by visiting it, how would I know which to do? So sort of the trick I played, and you may see it if you read the notes carefully, is when I'm doing a declaration, I never visit the child by recursively calling the type checker on the child. What I do instead is at the parent node, I do a field reference and go down and grab the name of the field. So if this were in the context of a var decal, something like integer int, integer ident, at the var decal node, I would say, yeah, I have to have a name, this is a declaration, so I'll reach down, I won't type check him, because that would imply either a lookup or a declaration, but I'll grab his name out. I know from the upper context that this, in fact, is a declaration, so I'll go ahead and put them in the symbol table. On the other hand, if I'm using the identifier as a use, so for example, ident equals 1 as part of an assignment, that's a case where I would go down and visit the identifier, probably as part of a name, and go ahead and say, okay, this guy now is in a position where he can be type checked because the declaration's already been processed. So in general, if I visit something like an identifier, that means I expect him already declared and I expect a lookup in the symbol table. If it's part of a declaration, be it a label or something else, and we'll see that in a bit, I don't actually go down and type check the subtree. I get at him at a distance, knowing he must be an identifier, grab his text, and do it remotely. Now, that is one level up. That's how I get around this problem of when I visit a node, how do I know if it's in a declaratory context or in a use context? Declarations are less frequent than uses, so I handle them a little separately. So in this case, I expect the operands, if they're identifiers, to be uses, so I will visit it. So in this case, I type check the left and right operands. That means I go ahead and visit them guys recursively by doing a visit on the type checking, and I expect the type and kind info to be applied into these nodes. Now again, you wrestled probably the case that sometimes these guys will fail for a variety of reasons, and it may be that I end up having an error type instead of a valid type. Generally, all these checks have to be weighted by the fact that you may need to check also that the guy is non-error before you progress. And usual rule is if a type is erroneous, that means any further checking with respect to the type is not possible, not reasonable. So if, for example, I looked to the left subtree and I looked him up and he was undeclared. Well, I don't need any type or kind info, so I say this is an error. And that means I won't come up in an error message saying error, the left operand is illegal. I don't know if it's illegal or not. I know the identifier is undeclared. Anything beyond that, I'll only know when the identifier becomes declared. So when you have error types, those are implicitly concerns. So all these checks are really saying if they're not error, go ahead and make the check that they might be valid. If they're one or the other or both erroneous, then hold back on the checks. So check they're both scalars. That's because in our language, you can't do things like add one array to another with a plus sign. Some languages you can, in which case the type checking would have to know that's legal. The kind is going to be a value. That means I'm doing a computation. Value means, unlike a variable, you can't assign to a value. Once you've added A and B, you can't assign to it. So I can say something like I plus 1 equals 3. And you say, well, duh, of course. But it turns out there are actually some languages where you can actually have an expression on the left-hand side, and in certain circumstances, it will invert the expression to do it. So we can't do it, and most languages can't. But in a simple thing like this, it would say, what you really want is to solve a problem that says, give me a value of I such that I plus 1 equals 3. So instead of saying I equals 2, I say I plus 1 equals 3. And there are actually some languages that allow that. Ours doesn't. As you can see, this is, anybody who has a mathematical background says this is equivalent to solving some really nasty-looking equations. So in general, it's not doable. But people have experimented with it, and there's some cool ideas. So whenever you say something's not possible, it may not be feasible, but certainly people have thought about it and in some cases experimented with it. So it's some cool ideas there. So in this case, the result is a value. Now we kind of subcase it depending on the three kinds of operators. If the operator is called arithmetic, then you check that the operands have an arithmetic type, integer, or character. There were questions about that, and does that mean that I'm allowed to intermix character and integers in an expression? And the answer is yes. If you want, you can say something like little a plus 1. And that would say, find the character code for a. Remember, characters are treated as bytes, and bytes really are numbers because, you know, a character is just a number, and if so, you can add it. That's sort of a legacy of C, and Java perpetuated it, so we did too in that case. And, of course, the result type is an integer. One thing I mentioned about error types is that in the case of these operators, because they're so constrained, I can figure out what the result type must be purely from the operator. So even if I had something like an undeclared identifier plus 1, I could say that I know the result of plus has to be an integer and put that in the tree so that people further up the tree are not misled by the fact that there's some doubt. Plus has to return an integer. So the undeclared identifier has to be fixed. But when it's fixed, no matter how you fix it and get past type checking, it's still going to be an integer. Otherwise, it'll have other errors and have to be fixed yet again. Yeah, question? No, they're different types. They're interchangeable. This is a little example of that conversion. I was talking about a float and int and so on. They're both considered arithmetic in the sense that they can be used as operands. And in some sense, you have to know the history of what they're really going back to is saying in the old days, C did not consider a character very much different than a byte, which is actually a one byte long integer. They kind of mix them interchangeably. So in this particular case, I include this just so I can talk about the pros and cons of it. And maybe in future languages, they'll get away from that and force conversion. I don't know. But you're absolutely right. They're not the same type. And certainly, in some cases, and one of the ways we know that is if I say print a character variable, it'll print out a character. If I say print out an integer variable, it'll print out numbers, not the character. And that certainly is an observable difference. So in this particular case, if it's not an arithmetic operator, check if it's a binary operator, and or, in which case both operands have to be Boolean and the result is Boolean. And if it's a relational operator, you check that both have an arithmetic type or both have a Boolean type. And again, here's a case where it certainly does make sense to intermix characters and integers. I can ask something like if character is equal to 32. And if ch is a character variable, what's 32? There's a magic thing. What's octal 40, which is happened to be decimal 32? Come on, you lived through that. That's the old blank. So this is kind of an indirect way of saying, is it a blank? And in this case, you know, you just probably put a blank character. But if you're looking for some special unprintable, it might be the case you used a numeric code rather than trying to put some escape sequence or something. So that's certainly something there. And the result type is, of course, Boolean. Assignments, it's a situation here where you have to assign to a name node. It's a name node rather than an identifier because you can't assign to a subscripted variable. So a sub I may be assigned to. You type check the expression tree. The kind has to be assignable, and that means that things that can be assigned are variables, arrays, scalar params, or array params. If the kind is a scalar, the left-hand side, then you have to have the right-hand side also be scalar, and you check that in return. If the name node and expression trees kinds are both arrays, you have to check length. And here's a question where somebody came up with a fair question just recently today. You may or may not have caught up on it on Piazza. And that is, namely, how in the world do I get the length of the right-hand side of an assignment of an array? So I have AR1 gets AR2. I can certainly have the name AR1, and that's supposed to be a semicolon, believe it or not. So I can do that, but how about AR2? And here we're going to use a special little trick. If you think about things that are expressions that can return an array, there's only one thing that can do it, and that's really an identifier. I can name an array, but I have nothing that computes an array. I don't have a function that returns an array. I can't add arrays and arrays to get arrays, etc. So in this particular case, if there's an array that I'm being assigned, I know, although this is expression, it's got to be the special case in this situation of a name node, and particularly an identifier with a null subscript. And therefore, it's possible for, in this context, of all the expressions that might be there, to expect that one, and therefore go in there and actually go around and get the guy's name, look it up in the symbol table, and check the length. And of course, if they're parameters, you check the length at runtime. So that's a subtle little thing, and I'm glad somebody caught that, and I thought I'd share that since it came to mind. And, okay, that's assignment. Okay, while loops, that's this notion about labeling again. So in this case, we have a while node that may have a label or may not. In this case, I know the label is going to be an identifier. In this case, I think the syntax actually said this is an expression node, but it's an expression node which, because of the parser, has to be one particular kind of expression, namely an identifier. So we put that expression node in there to essentially satisfy the grammar, but in this case, we know that general expressions are not allowed. The parser will not produce them. So in this case, we have to type check the middle tree. It's got to be a Boolean, and it also has to be scalar. If label's a null node, then you simply type check the body of the loop, the statement node, which, of course, oftentimes is a block. Oh, by the way, I didn't talk about in my notes type checking blocks. Is there any construct that we have in the notes that are similar to blocks in terms of type checking? And the answer is yes, methods. If you think about a block in terms of type checking, isn't a heck of a lot different than a method. So what you do in a method is you handle all this extra nonsense about the parameters and all that. But suppose you had a method, you know, that's parameterless. Then in that particular case, what do you do after you've set up the trivial bit of information? You type check the declarations in the body and the statements in a body, opening a new scope, because of course declarations have to be in a local scope. Well, a block is very similar. A block says open a new scope, type check the declarations in that scope, and then type check the statements. And somebody is saying, oh my gosh, you know, this is kind of wasteful, because in a lot of cases, people use blocks without declarations. You know, they might have something like if A is equal to 1, then do a couple of things. B gets 2 and C gets 3. So you use a block not because you want new declarations, but because you want a list of statements rather than a single one. And you say to them, oh my gosh, I'm wasting all this time. I opened a new scope, there were no declarations, and I closed the scope. And that's true. And We'll talk a little bit later about processors and so on. So, but you're unlikely to be able to notice a difference in speed. So the pragmatic point of view says it works. If he doesn't use it, he doesn't need to use it. But it's also the case if you want to have a slight optimization. And again, here you're saving a little bit of time, but you're also making the code a bit more complex. Now, many of you are probably project leaders or project things. Is that the sort of trade-off you like or dislike? You make the program a little more efficient, but you also make it a tad more complex by checking. But anyway, what you could do in this case is, before you open the scope for the declarations, you could ask, are there any declarations? Is it hard to ask, are there any declarations? You go down to the subtree, that's the decals node, and what do you ask? Is you null? And if you're not null, then you do it. If you are null, which is a very common case, then you don't need to open the scope. Because in this particular case, these statements are going to execute in the existing block structured context without any problems. So this is one I'm a little iffy about. I like efficient code, but it's also a situation every time you add a little bit of extra logic to a program, you make it that much more difficult to understand and maintain. And I'm perfectly happy if you're saying, well, my God, I never thought about that. Fine, don't think about it again. Again, it's just my job to make you lose sleep at night about things that you could have done right or not done right. In fact, except for the guy I talked about yesterday, has anybody figured out, this is totally separate from this, but it just came to mind, about how you check for this obscure rule that says the very last method in a class must be main, and it must be a method of no parameters returning void. First of all, why am I requiring that? Because if I have to have a main because that's where the program starts, and if I put main anywhere but the last position in the list, what bad things happen? Any methods after main are not reachable. Because remember, the rule is a name only becomes visible at when you reach its declaration. So it's saying, really, have you organized your class the best way? If not, you're going to get a surprise anyway. The question is, how do you check that? No, there's no method that says, are you last? So how do you check that? Yeah. Yeah, okay. And where did you put that check?
Cool.
And the reason I did it in a slightly different place, I put mine up in the class node, figuring all the declarations have been processed and just grab the one. But what you have there is even better, I think. Good idea. So what he was saying is you expect to find a main, and if you never find a main, you've got some kind of way of catching that. So you look for the main and say, do you have anybody after me? If so, issue there. I did it the other way, namely, after all the methods have been processed, go back. And I had a little method that shot down the method decals list, found the last guy, and then just gave me a reference to him. And I said, is your name main? Do you take no parameters? Is your return type void? But, so if you're running how to do that is, sometimes this is just programming. And sometimes, the programming's very elegant. In other cases, it's a little bit of amounts to brute force. So anyway, we were talking about while loops. So we check that the condition is scalar. And if the label is null, you just check the body. That's easy. The more complex one is there a label? If that's the case, then this is really a declaration. So you check that the declaration is not already in the table. Remember I said it's extra credit, and if you're still at the point where you're working about extra credit, you could change this rule slightly so that a label can coexist with any other declaration of the same identifier. That would normally work pretty well because labels are used only in breaks and continues and on a while loop, and other identifiers are used in all other different contexts. So telling a label from non-label is pretty easy. So, is this guy meant to be a label or not? Well, if it's on a while loop, it's meant to be a label. If it's broken or continued, it's a label. Otherwise, it's obviously not a label. So you could make that share. We're not doing that. So we're simply saying label is not already in the table. We enter it. And this is where we do that visible versus hidden business. We're going to put him in the table, and I'm about to check the body of the loop. So I want him to be considered visible there. That means if I see a break or continue that looks up that label and says he's visible, that means he's got to be visible because the break or continue is in the body of the loop I'm currently processing. Later on, as you'll see in a couple of lines later, we change into hidden. Oops. Okay. So what happens then is I type check the entire body, see any valid breaks or continues, And when I get back to the root of this while, I say, okay, he's still declared because I don't want to have an undeclared identifier error. But now he's hidden. So if anybody else talks about him in another while loop, for example, I'd say, okay, yeah, I found him. Yes, he's a label, but he's hidden, which means that he's not accessible and may not be used. And we'll see that in a couple of slides. So my little dinger went off, so let's take a little break before my voice goes out, and we'll see you in about 15 minutes.